It's Ideasphere with union organizer Sean Richmond. Tell the bosses we're coming.
My experience as an organizer has convinced me that we won't grow until we kick the boss out of the doctor's office. Because on successor agreements, you come to the table and on day one, the boss is asking for concessions. You organize a new union, you're trying to make some wage increases, and on day one, the boss puts the healthcare on the table and says, you guys got to pay more into it.
A myriad of issues have come to light as we deal with this COVID pandemic. We're discovering weaknesses not only in our healthcare, but workforce. Neither is in good shape. While millions of workers have lost their health insurance, others are required to return to work under very hazardous conditions. Hello, I'm Guy Rathbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. If America still had the labor unions like those that existed in the 1950s, this country's workforce would be much better equipped to deal with the pandemic. Labor organizer Sean Richmond has spent the last 15 years as a union rep. His book reveals the slow erosion of unions over the past 40 years. It's titled, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. While the current labor conditions are concerning, Richmond asserts, at this moment, it's also pregnant with possibilities. Richmond is the program director at the Harry Von Arsdahl Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY, Empire State College. His writings have been published in The American Prospect, In These Times, The New York Daily, and New York Times. And he joins me for this program. Sean, thanks so much for taking this time.
Thanks for having me.
As I'm reading your book, I'm aware of the issues that have floundered for the past several decades now, and you bring to my attention the disparity in workers and the leaders of our country. But you write that laws need to be changed. We're considered the peasants in a fiefdom.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that one of the issues I'm really trying to press on when we're thinking about how to reform our labor laws, we need to think about workplace governments. There's a government at every workplace. Most places it's a dictatorship. If you have a union, it is maybe a constitutional monarchy. But we do this very strange thing in this country where we smush together the function of workplace government and political party, and we have the union do both, and it introduces a lot of signal noise. One of the things that really drives me nuts is when a politician says, and we need to make the law, make it easier for workers to organize. It's never easy to organize. That's not the point. The point is that there should be a workplace government on day one and that the employer should have no ability to secede from it. So whether that it looks like the German Works Council model, which I talk a little about in the book, whether that looks like sectoral bargaining or industrial labor codes, but something where no matter what workplace you are in America, you will have a system of representation. And then you get to decide what union you want to join, maybe multiple unions.
This is good. You bring up the fact that there is the possibility for labor codes in the future. Would you like to outline some of that?
Well, so it's a very old first New Deal model. And we tend to think of the New Deal as sort of having happened all at once, and it didn't. Roosevelt had a very different approach in his first few years than he did by the time we had the National Labor Relations Act. The National Recovery Administration, which was meant to get us out of the Depression, was much more of a sort of a pro-corporate, let's let businesses collude over prices so that they stop this race to the bottom. And it dealt unions in so that in addition to the sort of the price codes that industries would set, they also had to have a labor code and they had to recognize representatives of the workers in that process. It didn't work perfectly, very confused, and it wound up sparking a pretty significant strike wave in 1934. And then the Supreme Court overturned it. But there are vestigial elements of this that are still hanging out there because a lot of states made laws that matched that. And very interestingly, in New York State, the fight for 15, when the workers in fast food finally won a 15-hour minimum wage, they actually did it by some very smart people figured out that there was still this law on the books in New York that would allow for a sort of a tripartite form of bargaining to set an industrial code. They could set a different minimum wage for just this one industry from everybody else. And it was used as the mechanism to get that $15 minimum wage. And in the process, it sort of turned the Service Employees International Union into a true believer on this. At the time that the deal was made, there was no guarantee that the labor board was going to agree to $15. It was sort of like it could have been 10, it could have been 12. But the process of hearings all around the state and worker testimony and one-day strikes, it convinced the public representative and the employer representative to switch their votes and to set a $15 minimum wage. It was a total win. And, you know, I mean, in fast food, you've got some people that are paying union dues voluntarily. For the most part, it's a non-union industry, but that labor board can turn that $15 minimum wage into a $20 minimum wage, which is really what closer to what needs to be at this point. And we could do that in every industry, and we should. And then unions and collective bargaining could operate side by side with that, can even use that process to sort of leapfrog a union collective bargaining agreement with the industrial labor code and just back and forth. I play with some of those thoughts in the book about like what this would look like in telecom, you know, and when it comes to cell phones, you've got three companies. One of them has a union, the other two do not. If you had a labor board that could take in the AT&T wireless contract and apply it to Verizon and T-Mobile, that'd be a very interesting way of using the AT&T bargaining. If you had it where you would press for some new wage increase or some new, you know, scheduling standard at the Industrial Labor Board that isn't in the AT&T contract, and you decide that you're going to focus your ire on Verizon, you might win it at the labor board. You also might get Verizon starting to think, geez, how can we get in on some of this sweet, sweet no-strike action that comes with having a collective bargaining agreement like AT&T has?
I want to spend a minute on this issue because I'm assuming you started this work before there was COVID-19.
Yeah.
You were recognizing that just possibly there would be major changes coming in our elections of 2020. So you were going to point that out. In the meantime, what happens is, as you're talking about putting money in workers' pockets, that's a glaring error in our system now because the gig jobs are seriously dented and harmed completely. There are part-time workers who may never return to work, and there's no workplace governance anymore.
Yeah, and I guess I think we on the left sometimes tell ourselves some very disempowering legends and just some disempowering basic logic, assumed logic. So, you know, we tell ourselves that labor law won't change until we spark the general strike or, you know, we get the sit-down strikes going again. And so we should just focus everything we got on getting the sit-down strikes going. And then the law will follow. Which, A, that means, great, you've spent all your time, you know, doing that, and then somebody else gets to make the law. I do think we should be spending some time while we're trying to get the general strike, also thinking about what the law should look like. But B, not entirely accurate. That National Recovery Administration that I talked about, you know, passed in 1933, labor was at a total low ebb. And there was no reason in the world for Roosevelt to put union rights into that law, except that, A, he just needed one less critic of a very controversial bill. And B, he had enough people in his ears saying, you know what, the reason we're in a Great Depression is that workers don't have bargaining power. If we can increase their bargaining power, they could get more spending money, and then there'd be more consumer demand, and the economy would start to get on its feet again. So crisis precipitates a legal change. That's true. But what I was trying to call attention to is we were already in a crisis. Before COVID, we were in a crisis. And you had just enough power brokers within the Democratic Party recognizing that the reason you got Trump is because Michigan went right to work, you know, that we're down to 7% density in the private sector, that Democrats need unions to get elected and reelected. The Republicans understand that, and the Democrats only just figured that out in November of 2016. So there was always a good possibility that if we had a Democratic president in 2020, if we had a Democratic Senate, if we held on to a Democratic Congress, that we could win something. And what I'm trying to put my finger on is it might not be good enough what we win. It might be just enough, like the National Industrial Recovery Act. It might be just enough to raise workers' hopes and then dash their expectations to actually trigger the general strike.
It's a conundrum that you have here, and I want to get deeper in this workplace governance as well, because it's affecting all aspects of it. Reminding listeners that I'm talking with Sean Richman, a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative and the program director at the Henry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies in New York. The book is Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. I want you to pass along your website or any blog you would recommend, anything else to get more information.
Well, it's actually hardcover, so forgive the cover price. It will come out in paperback.
I have an uncorrected proof.
Election in hardcover, and then we'll have a second bite at the apple if we get a Democratic president. And we want to get this book getting passed around in, on Capitol Hill in early 2021. But my website, my name is spelled S-H-A-U-N-R-I-C-H-M-A-N. And so my website is seanrichmond.org. So I'm not running my life for the profit. I would also recommend In These Times magazine, inthesetimes.com, where I was really working out a lot of these ideas in a series of articles that I started publishing in the fall of 2015. Because, yeah, I mean, writing the book was really born out of a frustration as a union staffer of just, you know, I mean, I ran the charter school organizing division for the AFT. And, you know, I'm spending $4 million a year to organize 1,000 workers. You know, 1,000 workers a year. But I mean, you know, that's just, and the reality is that the system is a trap. And it's a trap in a lot of ways that I think gets missed in a lot of the discourse. I felt like there were a lot of really good books out there that said, hey, the reason that our economy is a mess is that we don't have unions. But then it just sort of talks about unions as an abstraction. And I'm saying what a union is very complicated. It's partly a function of the law. It's partly a function of union leaders and staff sort of following, you know, and it is what it is, sort of handed down model of best practices and tradition. And we have to sort of break it down into its component parts and really, really evaluate what's working and what isn't. Because there's just, to bring unions back from the edge of annihilation where we find ourselves, we can't bring back unions that looked like they did in 1972. The bosses won't let us. We have to fundamentally restructure our organizing strategies. We need totally different laws. We need very different approaches to a lot of these questions. And you know, in my book, I'd like to think that I'm raising more questions than I am, you know, preaching this is what you should do. Right. The smartest people in the labor movement, you know, we occasionally meet, you know, at these conferences and we laugh amongst ourselves like, who the hell knows? Let's try something, you know?
Yeah, but you have a wall up against you for the federal supremacy, as you refer to it. But then you write that the weight of labor laws has become literally unconstitutional in violation of the First and Fifth Amendment rights.
I think so. And this is a thing that, like, you have to get away from Washington, D.C. to see. And I did. I did this labor studies program at UMass where my law professor was this guy, Harris Freeman. And one day in the law class, he just asked us, all right, where do you think labor law derives its constitutionality? And we all start guessing, you know, perfectly reasonable guesses. You know, oh, First Amendment, freedom of assembly. Fifth Amendment, due process. I guess 13th Amendment, slavery and involuntary servitude. Perfectly reasonable request. And he goes, no, it's the Commerce Clause. And it was like such a light bulb moment for me. It's like, oh, that's why everything's broken. Because our human rights are based upon our impact on commerce. Of course we're going to lose under that framework. So what's happened is on day one, after the Supreme Court says, okay, fine, the National Labor Relations Act is unconstitutional, the bosses immediately started challenging all kinds of small parts of it by saying, look, hey, we have a First Amendment right. Right. So like on the question of union elections at the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Act was intended to be a neutrality law that the workers get to decide if they have a union. The boss doesn't get to say a word about it. And the bosses go to the Supreme Court and they say, you know what? We do have a First Amendment right to at least express our opinion. And of course, the Supreme Court agrees with them. And on our side, we're just left saying, well, you know, you said this law is constitutional based on the Commerce Clause. Therefore, vote against the bosses here. The First Amendment is always going to beat the Commerce Clause. So now you get to the year, you know, it's the year 2020, and an NLRB certification election, which decides whether workers will have extra statutory rights under the law in order to bargain a contract. The rules of this, it's an election that's conducted by an arm of the federal government. And the rules are that one party and one party only can force all of the voters into a mandatory presentation of their position. And within that presentation, they can lie, they can threaten your job, they can hire somebody to impersonate a federal officer to lie about what your rights even are. And crucially, it's not just that only a boss can do this, but it's only a boss that advocates a no vote. A yes vote would also somehow be illegal. And the union yes vote has no right to respond, has no equal time provision. When you step back from it, and you get out of Washington, D.C., How is that not a massive violation? Coerced political speech, right? The issue that was at the heart of the Janus case. How is that a totally egregious example of coerced political speech?
Okay, you bring in the Janus case here. I was going to go another direction, but you just mentioned this Supreme Court case of 2018. You say that really stripped the fairness of labor unions.
I don't talk about it much in my books. I think sort of overdone. I'm sort of embarrassed by unions who sort of revealed that, like, you know, at the end of the day, it really was about the dues money for them. You know, I mean, I was coming up with these very novel arguments of like, well, if they do that, then we should do this. You know, like a First Amendment argument that we shouldn't have to represent everybody, that there should be multiple unions at the workplace, that we could break the no strike clauses and just make them miserable, because exclusive representation, which goes hand in hand with the agency fee, is what the bosses want. It works for them because it guarantees them a period of labor peace. And so if they start tugging at the threads of this, we should have made them regret doing that. But the other thing that Janus reveals, which is an argument against what I'm saying, is the courts are totally stacked against us. There was no logic to the decision. I almost wish they just put out a one-page state, you know, decision that said, screw you, we have the votes. That'd be way more honest than pretzel logic they had to come up with about why this was a violation of the First Amendment, but you know, how other restrictions on unions aren't. This is the problem, though, with challenging labor law on a constitutional basis, which is what I argue. I've been arguing for a while, and it's an argument that I'm making sort of, I'm trying to call out a very bad political dynamic within the unions, which is that, particularly in Washington, D.C., the lawyers get to have the last word, organizational strategy. And the lawyers are pursuing a very cautious pathway. Now, to their defense, the Janus argument is exhibit A of why they might be right. You go to the court and who knows what the judges are going to do, but they hate us and they're probably going to rule against us. But I would say that the cautious approach is just a strategy for losing more slowly. The judges are going to come after us anyway. So I think we should be strategic about calling out some of the blatant hypocrisy and some of the blatant unconstitutionality of all of this. And we might win some cases. We might, you know, we might tear away at the legitimacy of what is a very illegitimate court at this point. And let chaos rule for a while.
Well, right now, as you note very succinctly, the National Labor Relations Board really has no teeth. It hasn't the strength. It's underfunded, as you say, and hobbled essentially by
teeth. It has teeth because when we have a Republican president, it is a perfect union busting operation. It's a perfect machine.
Yeah.
It's one Democrat that it's weak and it's underfunded and it's not appreciated. I mean, we definitely need strategies about how we use the NLRB. I've got a whole chapter in there about what our strategy should be for a legislative amendment to it, which it's not just change this rule, change this rule. We should have much stricter instructions to the courts within the act that says, back off, we think you tend to get this right. That says, by the way, we're legislatively overturning every Supreme Court decision about this law because you got it wrong and we think you're always going to get it wrong. There's norms that are respected that I think are just completely ridiculous. The law says that it's the policy of the federal government to encourage collective bargaining. Donald Trump has only appointed Republicans to this board. He's left a couple of seats vacant because there's a handshake deal that goes back since, I don't know, 1950-something, that when there's a Republican president, there'll be three Republicans and two Democrats. When there's a Democratic president, the reverse. And he just decided, I'm not going to appoint Democrats. And the Republicans are issuing these ridiculous decisions, and they're just flat out saying, we don't believe that it's our job to encourage collective bargaining. And when you get to that point, I don't know why a President Biden or, you know, whoever succeeds him shouldn't say, I'm not going to appoint based upon party label. I'm going to appoint based upon if you agree with the statutory commitment of the law. Period. End of story.
Yeah.
You want a multi-partisan labor board, put two Democrats, a socialist, a Green Party member, and an independent.
My guest for this program is Sean Richmond, who has spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. His observations have been published in The American Prospect, Indies Times, The New York Daily, and New York Times. Check out his website at seanrichmond.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back.